Good evening. I'm Mark Bartlett, the head librarian of the New York Society Library, and welcome to the members' room of the library, and I'm glad you all came out on this rather chilly Wednesday night. Tonight I am really pleased to welcome to the library Dr. Carla Peterson, the author of Black Gotham, A Family History of African Americans in 19th Century New York City. Published by Yale University Press in 2011, Dr. Peterson's book won a New York City Book Award for History this past May, and tonight we brought out Dr. Peterson's book as well as the other two winners, so feel free to have a look after the event. Our friends from the Corner Bookstore are out in the Peluso Family Exhibition Gallery. They'll be happy to sell you a copy of the paperback or hardback of this fine work, and Dr. Peterson will be happy to autograph for you after the event. Before we begin, and I actually did just hear one, so thank you for turning off your cell phone, and if anybody else has a cell phone or a pager, now would be the time to take it out and silence it. We actually record these events for library members and for the general public, so if your cell phone is on and it rings tonight, it'll be on YouTube forever, so just remember that. This is the time of year when we ask you to support our annual fund. The funds we raise have an impact on every area of this library. They support our growing collection, they support our writers' services, our seminars, and the great staff of the library. So please give as generously as you can. And if you have already contributed, which many of you have, I thank you very much on behalf of the board and staff of the library. Tonight, Dr. Peterson will share with you what is both a very personal story, as you'll find reading her book, discovering more about her 19th century ancestors, and the broader story of our beloved city of New York in a time of great change. One online review of Black Gotham that I was looking at recently said, Dr. Peterson provides a wonderful, exciting, and riveting account of how she was able to, in many ways, reconstruct the lives of her 19th century ancestors while at the same time providing an equally wonderful reconstruction of the history of ordinary African Americans and the growing African American elite in New York City. Dr. Peterson is an affiliate faculty member of the American Studies, African American Studies, and Women's Studies departments at the University of Maryland in College Park, and she holds a PhD from Yale University. She's also the author of Doers of the Word, African American Women Speakers and Writers in the North, 1830 to 1880, and she's published widely in scholarly periodicals, including French Forum, American Literary History, and American Quarterly. So please welcome Dr. Peterson.
Thank you so much, Mark, for that lovely introduction, and thank you for inviting me a second time, and above all, thank you for the prize, which came as such a surprise a few months ago. I was really delighted. So can you all hear me okay? Yeah? Okay. So tonight, obviously, I'm going to talk about my book, and I'm going to talk for about 40, 45 minutes, I hope. When I get started, sometimes I just can go on and on and on, and I can't cut it off, but I'm going to try and limit myself to 45 minutes maximum. After that, we can have a Q&A, and there are points at which I am going to say I don't want to talk a lot about that because I'd talk forever, and so maybe you would want to. We can delve into that more in the Q&A. I did a digital archive based on the book. I started it, and it was launched in June, and I have to say I've been delinquent in keeping up with it. But at the end, as I'm doing Q&A, we can just kind of flash it up and you can see. So when you finish the book or as you're reading the book, if you want to see more images, you can get it from the digital archive. So the digital archive is, because we all have to be up to date these days, right? We can't just languish behind in 19th century production of books. So I'm going to start off with two quotes at the beginning and explain what I mean by them. Oh, and on each of your seats, you should have a shortened version of my family tree. I have a lot of images, but the reason why this is not on the family tree is that I will be referring to them, and it would my ancestors several times, and going back and forth on PowerPoint would be awkward. So I'll tell you to refer to the family tree. I'm not mentioning all of these characters, but there will be some. So I want to start off, and excuse my hoarse voice. This seems a lot of people seem to be having that today. I want to start off with two quotes from the beginning of my book. The first is my own prose. The second is that of Toni Morrison. We still hold certain truths about African Americans to be self-evident, that the phrase 19th century black Americans refers to enslaved people, that New York State before the Civil War denotes a place of freedom, that blacks in New York City designates Harlem, that the black community posits a classless and culturally unified society, that a black elite did not exist until well into the 20th century. The lives of my New York forebears belie such assumptions. They were born free at a time when slavery was still legal in New York State. And as I think you all know, slavery was abolished in 1827 in New York State. They lived in racially mixed neighborhoods, first in Lower Manhattan, and then after the Civil War in Brooklyn, at a time when Harlem was a mere village. They were part of New York's small but significant black community, and specifically its elite class. So this was the project that I took for myself, and I said, I don't like these assumptions. How can I challenge them and overturn them and make people see and understand a different kind of history? And that took me then to the idea of a family history. And for those of you who have the book, the epigraph of the preface is this quote from Toni Morrison. From Beloved, Denver was seeing it now and feeling it through Beloved. And the more fine points she made, the more detail she provided, the more Beloved liked it. So she anticipated the questions by giving blood to the scraps her mother and grandmother told her, and a heartbeat. Denver spoke, Beloved listened, and the two did the best they could to create what really happened, how it really happened, was something and It was something only Setha knew, because she alone had the mind for it and the time afterward to shape it. And after I had reread Beloved and found that quote, it came to me exactly what I wanted to do, to challenge those broader and more general assumptions about history through family history. So what I do in the book is exactly what Denver and Beloved do. I recreate the past through the memories of forebears, memories that are not mine, but that belong to my ancestors. And I try, as Beloved and Denver say, to give blood and a heartbeat to these scraps of memory. And it seems to me that what I got out of that was that I could bring up in a very direct way the issues of memory and forgetting. And we all know about that in some way or another. You told me right before, your mother would never talk about what she did in World War II. She just didn't want to talk about it. But now you're finding out things. So what is it that families remember and talk about? And what is it that they, in a way, choose to forget and let go of? So it seems to me that getting at this issue of memory and forgetting, which pervades society, you can really get at through family history. The other thing that I thought was that when you do family history, you're talking about very specific individuals. You can't substitute. If you can't find, you can't say, well, I'll invent a grandfather and I'll talk about that person's experience. So that you're really getting at very specific lived lives and a way of history in the home, history on the street. And that to me seemed very important, especially for African Americans. The other thing that I thought of was that if you go back to the 19th century, the idea of the family was a very vexed issue for African Americans. We were not supposed to have families. We were not supposed to be capable of family life, of knowing anything about the ties that bind, about nurture. And that's why slave families were disrupted and destroyed so frequently in children's sold away from parents and so forth and so on. So the ability to be able to recreate history through an African American family became really also very important to me. And the last thing, I'm actually trained as a literary critic and not as a historian, but the last thing that I thought would be important, or at least that I could suggest, was that historians might want to think about family history as a really legitimate methodology. It's not memoir, it's family history. And could we learn something from family history that we can't from social history, from cultural history, or other kinds of history? So when I started, if you've read any the beginning of the book at least, I had nothing but one false story, and that was that of my great-grandfather, Philip Augustus White, who is I'm going to be talking about a lot. And I had his name, and I had a story that proved not to be quite accurate. So imagine having Philip Augustus White. White is the last family name, and that's all you know about your family. So there were no family documents, there were no stories. Yes, and you can start looking at your family tree and tracing. And so I assumed right at the beginning that there was no will to preserve, that my family and all these other 19th century African-American families had said, we don't want to remember this history. It was painful, it was traumatic, it was unimportant, whatever. But we don't want to remember it, and we're going to let it go. When I started doing my research, I found very much to the contrary. Throughout the 19th century, there was a will to preserve history, to hang on to African-American history. And it comes up in the newspapers that were published and recorded events of Africa about African-Americans in the period. It comes up through commemorative ceremonies. We must every year commemorate this event or that or the other that has to do with African-Americans. It comes up in the form of wanting to create a monument to honor an illustrious African-American now dead, and so forth and so on. But what I discovered then was the willingness to preserve, but the inability so often to preserve. And I'll give two examples, and the first one is very familiar to you, so I won't spend a lot of time on it. That is the Negro's burial ground. And Ray, you all know about the Negro's burial ground, right? Okay, so the burial ground that was in Lower Manhattan throughout the 18th century was the burial ground for African Americans. It was seen as part of the commons, right, of public ground. And in 1795, a family asserted that they were heirs to the land and got the city council to agree, and then they promptly sold off lots because Manhattan was expanding north, and it was becoming, from having been not valuable land, it had become very valuable land. And so by 1795, the burial ground had been sold out from under African Americans, and there was very little that they could do about it. The other thing, I want to give one more example, which is from James McCune Smith, who is, along with my great-grandfather, the hero of this book. And he talks about how the ways in which historical events, and he's talking mainly about the draft riots, erase so much of Black New Yorkers' archive. And the quote goes as follows. The New York City riot of 1863, among other disasters, has caused the destruction of nearly all the printed minutes of these conventions. So he's talking about conventions that gather together black New Yorkers every year to debate really important issues. So has caused the destruction of nearly all the printed minutes of these conventions, our Alexandrine Library, from which some of the noblest pages in the history of our people could have been selected. So the question I really faced was, how can I write some of the noblest pages of our history if these records have been destroyed? So I get then to the problem of the archive. And the first archive, and correct me if I'm wrong about the New York Society Library, which when I was writing my book, I have to say I had not heard about it. My guess from looking at what I looked at is that it was a library as opposed to an archive. So you can correct me after. But we have then, and this was found in 1754, but in 1804, John Pintard and a group of his friends, so 10 elite white men, New Yorkers, got together and decided to the New York Historical Society, and they really saw it as an archive, and they said, we want to preserve everything that is useful to our history. And of course, by useful, they had their own definition of what useful meant, and it included the political, the diplomatic, the commercial history of New York City. There's a certain amount about Native Americans that they were interested in preserving, but nothing really about African Americans. So we have to wait until Arturo Schomburg founds what's now the Schomburg Center in 1926. So that's 120 years later that we finally get a black archive in New York City. But that was really my only resource, was to go to the archives. So that's what I did. And as I was telling somebody before, this was 11 years of archival work and then writing. So if you read the book, you'll find out that the book unfolds on two levels. The first is my hunt in the archive, how I went chasing down every little detail I could, and then the putting together of the story. So I'm going to start right in with what I found, and I am going to start with my hunt at the Schomburg. And I went up to the Schomburg, and I was going through a collection of a woman who had written a book titled The Free Negro in Antebellum New York City, or something like that. And she'd left her notes. This is pre-computer, mind you. So she'd left all of her notes in those file boxes at the Schomburg. And I went through a box titled Biography, and this is what I found. And the name Philip Augustus White was right there, and that is my great-grandfather. So this was absolutely the first record that I found. And I was so excited. I said, well, let me see what else there is. And I was going through very systematically. And the very next one was that piece of paper was that. And I was like, well, this is Peter Guignon. I have no idea who he is, but let me be complete and read the obituary. So I read it, and long about in the middle, there is something about how his daughter, Elizabeth Guignon, marries Philip Augustus White. And I was like, wow, I found my great-great-grandfather. So you can turn to the family tree to see how this all sorts out. So I had two ancestors right there, and I thought, well, I am off and running. So just to give you a little bit of background on them, Peter Guignon, and to show you how little I have still figured out or found out, Peter Guignon was born in New York City in 1813. There is never any mention of his father. The mention of his mother is that he comes from the West Indies, and in that early period, West Indies was code for Haiti. And eventually I did discover, in fact, that his parents were Haitian. I still don't know anything about his father. My guess is that the father was a white Haitian and had come to New York with a black or mulatto slave, had settled in New York, not stayed with the family, because he's never mentioned. He's not. It's always Peter and his mother, and that Peter had to make it on his own. And he did so by going to school. He went to the Mulberry Street School, which I'll be talking about later. And then was kind of a jack of all trades. He was a porter in the cigar business, in hairdressing. And this was the period when he married my great-great-grandmother, Rebecca Marshall. So she's on the family tree. Rebecca, they have one child, Elizabeth. Rebecca dies very soon after the birth of Elizabeth. I don't know anything at all about her. And so he goes through being a jack of all trades. And then finally, sometime in the late 1840s, he marries a woman by the name of Cornelia Ray. And he's definitely marrying up, because Cornelia Ray came from a quite prosperous black New York family. And I'll be talking a little bit more about them later. But suffice it to say that Cornelia Ray's brother, Peter Williams Ray, was a doctor and had a pharmacy, a drugstore, and they brought Peter into the drugstore as a clerk, as a pharmacist. And at that time, there was no need for licensing. Anybody could be a pharmacist. You could walk out tonight and hang up a shingle saying, me, pharmacist, and that would be okay. He married up, and through, I guess, nepotism, he started to do really well. So his son-in-law is Philip Augustus White, and this then is his obituary, and then there's some poems pasted there, which I won't talk about now, but I can talk about later. And this gave me a lot of detail, and Philip's life was really different. I mean, the schematics were the same as Peter's, but the specifics are quite different. So Philip's father came from Northern England. He was a white man. His mother came from Jamaica. I have no idea how they met, whether it was in Jamaica or here, how they came to the States, what they did, etc. But the really interesting thing is that they lived together as an intact family. So a white man, maybe married, maybe not, I don't know, white man, husband, black wife, and a bunch of children lived together in an intact household in Hoboken, New Jersey, and then New York City until the father's death when Philip was around 11 or 12 years old. Philip went to a different free African school. When he came out, he was very determined to make a life for himself. So unlike Peter, he too became a pharmacist, but unlike Peter, he decided he was going to do it professionally. So he had an apprenticeship in James McCune Smith's pharmacy, first black doctor, and that was from 1840 to 42. And then he went to the College of Pharmacy of the City of New York and got a diploma in 1844. He didn't have to, but he was going to do it the right way. And he prospered. He did very, very well, had a retail business, and then went wholesale. With the money that he made, he gave it back to two causes. One was the education of black children, and the other was St. Philip's Episcopal Church. So that's a thumbnail sketch of the two heroes of my book. And I wanted to show you these photos. The man is named Albro Williams, and he is Peter Guignon's brother-in-law. So his wife is Mary Joseph Marshall, and she is the sister of my great-great-grandmother, Rebecca. So Mary Joseph and Rebecca were sisters. I have an image of Mary Joseph, but not of my great-great-grandmother, Rebecca. So the reason why I wanted to show you this was that in the Schomburg, I found another set of papers, and in it I found the diary by their daughter, or a memoir, Maricha Lyons, who becomes prominent in the second half of my book. And Maricha said in the memoir at the very beginning that her father had taken her aside one day and said, I always wanted to write a history of the men of my generation, and I was going to title it The Gentleman in Black. But I never got around to doing it. I never got any further than the title. So I want you to do it. So she does it, and she writes Memories of Yesterdays, all of which I saw, and part of which I was, an autobiography. And also in the preface, in the early part of the memoir, she says that she's writing it, compiling it, from the vast output of fugitive scraps. So here I have the word scraps in the Toni Morrison quote, in the scrapbook pages on which the obituaries were pasted, and then Maricha Lyons referring to the vast output of fugitive scraps. So in the beginning of my book, I invite my reader to read my book, to see my book as a scrapbook, and to read it as such. I take scraps, you were talking about this earlier, the way in which I take little scraps and try and put them together and make a story out of it. Okay, so on to the history itself. It's a chronological history that goes from the early 19th century to the late 19th century. It's chronological, it's cyclical, because it traces the ups and downs, the fortunes and misfortunes of Black New Yorkers. At the same time, it's what one could call a spatial history. So geography is very central to my story. And when Mark said earlier on, our beloved city of, you know, New York City is our beloved city. This is exactly the way 19th century African Americans thought of New York as our beloved city. So I thought of the way in which they inhabit the city as occupying concentric circles. So at the very center, you have the Black elite as the smallest circle. And I'm going to enumerate the circles and then come back and talk about some of them. So you have the Black elite, which is the educated, literate class. And then you have the Black community, which would be all African Americans in the city. And then you have Gotham itself, okay? So Gotham was a term, as I'm sure you know, coined by Washington Irving around 1809 in one of his funny little essays in Salmagundi, and he refers to New York as Gotham. And the name stuck with white New Yorkers, but it stuck with Black New Yorkers as well. They referred to New York as Gotham over and over again, and to themselves as Gothamites. And so that's living in the city itself. And then you have what's beyond Gotham, and I confess that that's the least I did in the book, ties with Blacks in Philadelphia and Boston, Rochester, Salem, and I don't have very much of that in the book. And finally, the last circle would be the cosmos, because one of the things that I point out in the book is how, despite their difficult, harsh condition, the fact that they didn't have much formal education, these men and women were cosmopolitan. They really knew about the out there, that what lay beyond not only Gotham, but the nation itself. So let me talk a little bit about the elite. I'm going to progress through some of the circles. So this is Collect Street, later Center Street, so you all know where that is. It doesn't look like that right now. But this is where several members of the Black elite resided from 1819 on. So I found the information in the municipal archives, and then I found this image. And what I like about the image so much is that St. Philip's Episcopal Church, the first building. But you see, then you see the street and how it's not paved. You see the barrel with a young Black boy and a white boy. And you see a man there. And what are the animals in front? And what are the pigs doing? Okay, they're collecting garbage, right? Although they're actually creating more garbage. So this, to me, seemed like a very wonderful image of New York in the period. And you have the nice building of St. Philip's, and then you have much more ramshackly frame houses. So what I found in doing my research was that there were at least three African-American families who owned property and built houses on the stretch, Collect Street, from 1819 on. And the families were the Crummels, the DeGrasses, and then my great-great-great-grandparents, the Marshalls. So once again, family tree time, you can see the Marshalls all the way at the top. So I started doing research on them, and what became so interesting to me is why did these people call themselves African? And that was the term that was used at the time. Because, in fact, they came from all over. They were truly, truly cosmopolitan. So take the Crummels. Boston Crummel was born in Africa. He was kidnapped, brought to the United States by then, became a slave of Peter Schemmerhorn. So I'm sure you've heard of the Schemmerhorns, right? The good Knickerbocker family. And he was their slave until he ran away. So he was pure African. The woman he married was named Charity Hicks, and she was a descendant of the Quaker Hicks family from England. So she was a mixed blood or on the Black side of the Hicks family. The next family, the DeGrasses, George DeGrasse had been adopted by a French count, an admiral in the Navy, Count de Grasse, when Count de Grasse had a stint with the French Navy in India. And he had adopted George de Grasse from Calcutta. George de Grasse was an Indian from Calcutta. The woman he married was named Maria van Surley. She was of Dutch and Moroccan ancestry. Then we get to the Marshalls, who are my great 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 grandparents. She is a Hewlett from Long Island, so a descendant of the British Hewlett family that came over in the 1600s. So she was on the black side of the Hewlett family. And the man she married was named Joseph Marshall, and he came from Venezuela. So I didn't realize it at the time, but somebody pointed out to me about a year ago, you've got all five continents covered there. So this is a truly cosmopolitan group who knew about the world. They knew about global affairs. So what made them elite? Education. They went to school. They insisted on the importance of education and went to school themselves and sent their children to school. So this is the famous African free school. It was called the Mulberry Street School because it was on Mulberry Street. And my great-great-grandfather, Peter Guignon, went to school there with a whole bunch of men, young boys, who later became very famous in a way that Peter Guignon never did. So here is James McCune Smith. He finished school, went to the University of Glasgow Medical School, graduated first in his class, came back and set up a medical practice and pharmacy on West Broadway. This is Charles Reason, who got an advanced degree in literature and was a professor at McGrawville College and then came back to New York to teach in the public schools. This is George Downing, whose father's Thomas Downey ran that very famous oyster house right on Broad Street, to which all the city officials came. He later moved to Newport, Rhode Island, where he established a very, very fancy resort called the Seagirt House. And the descriptions of it are just amazing. He was a fervent integrationist, believed that the solution to the race problems in the United States was through integration. He became very, very close to Charles Sumner, the Massachusetts senator, and Charles Sumner died in his arms. This is Alexander Crummell, famed Episcopal clergyman. He spent 20 years in Liberia, so he's the son of Boston Crummell and Charity Hicks. Spent 20 years in Liberia, then came back to the United States in 1870 and befriended young W.E.B. Du Bois. Long before Du Bois, Alexander Crummell had been thinking and meditating on the issue of the soul, and so much of which is in Du Bois's Souls of Black Folk is directly attributable to Alexander Crummell, and yet we know so little about this man today. Okay, let me stop there. So these young men, and then there was a girls' school, had what was really, for the time, a pretty good education. And by education, it was in the liberal arts, what we mean by, literature, history, natural science, philosophy, geography, et cetera, et cetera. So that was the knowledge part. Equally as important, then, is the idea of character and respectability, what is inside you and the moral development, and then also the sense of cosmopolitanism. Out of this, then, out of their training, they went into different trades, but they also insisted on they became leaders and insisted on community building and founding all kinds of institutions, political associations to get the right to vote, literary societies to encourage people to read, something very much like the New York Society Library, and so forth. So now I come to Gotham itself, and this, of course, is the famous image of Five Points. and which I'm sure you've all seen in one guise or another. And I show it to show the hurly-burly and the mixture of white and black. And if you were down there on the street, you would see Irish and German as well, and, you know, upper class and lower class, and merchants and tradesmen and beggars and so forth and so on. So what I want to say about coming off of this image is the way in which New York made class and race and ethnic distinctions. There was obviously social differentiation, but these different groups came together at all times, and that it was very hard, so that the chapter or the passage in the section in my book I call distance and proximity. There was a big difference between whites and blacks, a big difference between upper and lower class. The fact is they were cheek by jowl, and they lived within the same neighborhoods, not necessarily in the same building, not necessarily in the same block, but close enough that they could not avoid one another. This gave rise to what my great-grandaunt, Maritza Lyons, referred to as whimsy, or as whim. So the way in which when Black New Yorkers left their homes, they never knew what they were going to encounter. Yes, they were going to find white people, but how would white people respond to them? So what Maritza says is, I never knew whether I would get to ride the railroad car in order to get to school. Maybe one day the conductor would let me on. Maybe another day he wouldn't. And so that's the kind of thing that Black Americans or Black New Yorkers faced on a daily basis. And I have other examples, but I see that time is running away, so I better skip over them. So there's one area, though, in which I think that whim played much less of a part, and there was real kind of respect and understanding of the importance of skill. So this is a note that I found, one of these serendipitous encounters, in the New York Public Library Arendt's collection, which is about tobacco. And it refers to my great Peter Guignon's second wife's father, okay, Peter Ray. So he's on the sheet. And it says, do you want me to read it? Yeah. Peter Ray, or Ray, is the name of the mulatto man who sorts out the tobacco for Lorillard and who is so great a judge of leaf tobacco and which will do best for snuff and which for cutting, for smoking and chewing tobacco. To find him, look in the New York directory or ask one of Lorillard's men. December 27, 1842, he was working for Lorillard in his factory in Lawrence Street, New York. So what I found amazing, I went and I found the obituary of Peter Ray, and his story is an extraordinary one. In 1811, at the age of 11, Peter Ray was hired by the Lorillards as an errand boy in their tobacco factory. By the time he died in 1882, he was one of the superintendents of the new factory that the Lorillards had established in 1870 in Jersey City. That building was there a few years ago. I don't know whether it's been torn down. There was a whole hullabaloo in Jersey City about getting rid of it. And what it shows is there was no whimsy here. Basically, they saw this man and said, he's a really good judge of tobacco, of leaf tobacco, what's good for cutting, for smoking, for chewing, etc. We admire, we appreciate this skill, and we're going to hire him. And so that is one of the things that I found out in researching the book. The other example I wanted to give you, and then I'm going to talk very briefly about Brooklyn. This is Philip White, my great-grandfather, as an adult. I don't know the time, the specific date when it was done. People say I look just like him. I don't know what you think. You can tell me after. But I don't know, about a year ago, somebody just erupted and said, do you know you've brought your great-grandfather back? And I'm like, yes, of course, I wrote the book. And he's like, no, you look just like him. Anyway, so here he is, and he has a pharmacy downtown at the corner of Frankfurt and Gold Street. So it's around where Pace University is now. And during the draft riots, I found in Maritza's papers this note in the draft from the draft riots. Do you want me to read it? Yes, okay. I have received yours. So this is written by a police sergeant to Albro Lyons. I have received yours from the bearer, and I cannot answer whether I can comply with it. I will see you this afternoon, as I mentioned in the note, in the other note, as I have been excused from my captain for that purpose. I cannot say today what will occur tomorrow. I will be at said drugstore at 3 o'clock p.m. this day with horse and wagon. Yours truly, et cetera, et cetera. So the backstory to this note is that Philip White and Albro Lyons, I showed you the photo of Albro, lived on the same street in downtown, in lower Manhattan, basically near City Hall, so going towards the East River, in an area that was called the Swamp. And during the draft riots, the mob went to Albro Lyons' home and made a determined assault on it. They failed the first two times. The third time, they got in and ransacked the home. He was at 20 Vandewater Street. Philip was at 40 Vandewater Street, or maybe it's the other way around. His home was not touched, and neither was his drugstore. And my supposition, I can't be sure, but my supposition is that the drugstore that's referred to here was Philip White's. So the question, of course, is why was that safe when the mob was so determined to attack black people and property? How could a black man's drugstore be safe? So this is an account lifted from an obituary, actually from the New York Times, so we must believe it, right? When the riot was at its height, a crowd of men gathered at White's store to defend it from attack. Mr. White was warned by some of the businessmen that he would be wise if he hid himself. He said, "What have I to fear? Even if these men here could not protect me, there are as many men among the rioters who would fight for me as there are those who would injure me." Not the slightest attempt was made to harm him or his property. Philip White had made himself indispensable to his local community of a mixed community of poor white, of poor Irish and poor blacks. And the account goes on to talk about how Philip gave medicines away for free when his poor Irish neighbors couldn't afford it, gave them clothes, gave them money, gave them food. What reason would they have for attacking and destroying the his pharmacy, his drugstore? So the interdependence between Philip and his neighbors is something that I find really fascinating and not at all a result of whimsy. Okay, in the last five or seven minutes? Yeah, okay. I'm just like, I want to talk about the post-Brooklyn, the Brooklyn period. So blacks had started leaving New York actually from the 1840s on. 1840 is the high point of black population in New York City before the Civil War, and I think it's 16,000. By 1860, there's maybe 13,000 or whatever, and after the draft riots, down to 11, maybe 9,000. And many of the blacks then, black New Yorkers, go over to Brooklyn and become black Brooklynites. And their society starts to change. They are more elite and more. They've got more education, better housing, living conditions. Many of them have settled in Williamsburg, once again, a mixed then white and black neighborhood. And they, what they do there is they start to, there are two literary societies that are started at the time. First, the New York's Bethel Literary Association, and then after that folds the Brooklyn Literary Union. So what happens, the reason why I bring this up is I do want to get something in about women. So in the literary societies before the Civil War, they were male literary societies. Women could attend as guests to the lectures and the discussions and the debates, et cetera, but they did not participate. And what we find here is that women start participating, and they are debaters, and by 1890, they are lecturers as well. So this is one big difference, the beginning of the opening of doors to allow women's voices in. So some of the debates are, if you know about Booker T. Washington and Du Bois and the debate between these two men, those are many of the topics, some of those the topics that these men bring up are brought up here. So should we go for education or accumulation of wealth, right? If we have education, should it be industrial or classical? And then another huge debate would be, should we stay with the Republican Party? We've been a Republican since Abraham Lincoln, but what have the Republicans done for us lately? Maybe we should think about becoming Democrats. So these were some of the debates that were going on. So I'm going to focus on Maritza Lyons in this portion because she's a member of the Brooklyn Literary Union. And let me see. So Maritza. That is Maritza. So she is, first of all, a debater in some of these in the literary societies, and she then is also a school teacher. So I won't go into it, but the history of schooling in Brooklyn is really, really interesting. The schools were segregated until 1883 when my great-grandfather, Philip Augustus White, got the city of Brooklyn to pass a piece of legislation integrating the schools, but also saying that the three colored schools that existed could be maintained so that black families could choose whether they wanted to send their children to black schools where they would have black teachers and be within the neighborhood, or have them in white schools where they would be taught by white teachers who would perhaps be less understanding of them. So Maritza becomes a school teacher in this system. She helps to found then the Woman's Loyal Union, which is one of the black clubs of the period, and she's inspired by this person. And do you know who she is? Ida B. Wells, absolutely. So after Ida B. Wells has to run away from Memphis because of the editorial she writes in her newspaper, The Free Press, about lynching, she leaves New York, and she leaves Memphis, and she comes up to New York, and she stays in New York for a while, and she looks around, and she says, well, you women of Brooklyn, you're really nice, but you could be doing a lot more. You need to become part of the club movement and found a club. So they found the Women's Loyal Union, and one of the things that the Women's Loyal Union does is, following Ida B. Wells, is they're interested in information, accurate information about African Americans. So they send out all these questionnaires saying, what is the status of blacks in your part of the country or in your city in terms of education, housing, this and that, the other. So I find that fascinating, that it's that the need for accurate information was what was so important. They also lobbied Congress for different bills, et cetera. Out of this, they created they became part of the National Council of Colored Women. That's the umbrella group that brought together all of the black clubs, I think, in 1896. And the last thing I want to mention is their participation in the King's Daughters, because this is really an unknown history of collaboration between white and black women in this period. So who's heard of the King's Daughters? Okay, so sometimes people have. When I first heard about it, I'm like, well, Kings County, right? This is something to do with Brooklyn. But no, King is our father, the king, okay? And so this was a group, a national and then international group, founded by a white woman in New York City that she said was for women of leisure, who had leisure time and money, to devote themselves to charitable causes. And what she said was that women should come together in a group of 10 called a circle, choose a charitable cause, and donate to that cause time, money, energy, et cetera, et cetera. So circles were called like the Lower Light Circle, the Thoughtful Circle, et cetera, et cetera. And so these two circles, white women adopt for as their charitable cause the Zion Home for the Aged, which is an African-American home for the elderly in Brooklyn. And what then really astonished me was to find out that in very little time, a black circle had joined them. And it was called the Willing Workers Circle. And Philip White's, by then widow, Elizabeth Guignon White, was a member of that circle. And they came together collaboratively to work on the Zion Home for the Aged. And that was really the first kind of collaboration that I'd seen among black and white women in the area for a very, very long time. And the circles never integrated, but the board of managers did. So that Elizabeth White, at one point, was the second vice president. And that, to me, was really, really striking. And somebody needs to do more work on this King's Daughters. Okay, so I want to conclude after having gone like this, broadening out. I want to narrow down and just read one of the last paragraph of, or a part of it, of my book, which again takes you to another geographical place, and this is the cemetery. And it is Cypress Hill Cemetery. So this is just a short paragraph. On a windy October day last fall, so this is actually many, many falls ago, I took a trip to Cypress Hill Cemetery in Brooklyn. Armed with a map provided by the front office, I went searching for the graves of my forebears and their friends, who had left Lower Manhattan, later Brooklyn, for their final resting place. The White family plot lay on flat land near a broad path surrounded by tall leafy trees. Buried there were Philip's mother, Elizabeth, two of his sisters and their families, and Philip and his family. Alexander, Crummel, Charles Ray, and their families lay nearby. Right next to Philip's grave lay that of James McCune Smith, recently rediscovered and commemorated with a brand new marker. I was astonished to discover that all of these men had bought their plots at the same time, between January and May of 1850, determined that not even death would separate them. Crossing the path and walking up a hill, I found the land that St. Philip's Church had bought for its parishioners in the late 1850s. The Ray family plot, which included Peter Guignon, was notable for a tall obelisk that jutted skyward. In the waning years of the 19th century, New York's black elite reunited in this burial ground. Their graves are physical reminders of their lives and commemorations of their deaths. They serve as an archive, a place for safekeeping, for storing memories of the past that are simply waiting to be brought back to light and life in the ripeness of time. Thank you. So I'd be happy to answer any questions. And while we're doing that, Sarah is going to show you just my archive, which I launched in June and haven't done anything with. So this is the homepage. If you click on Black Gotham Stories, you get a lot of stories. And they're, as yet, most of them are from the book. So that's my grandfather. I shouldn't talk about that. Questions. I could go on. I need to stop. Questions. Yes. That, wait, say that again.
Well, you're introducing us to a very educated, very culturally sophisticated community, which most of us didn't know very much about.
Okay.
And I wonder what made it all, did they get overwhelmed by the migration from the South?
Okay, so there, within this, the black community was small, so this is an elite within, so it's even smaller. And one of the things I think was, although they lived mixed with white population, they were fairly, they congregated, right? It was a dense populating. And so one of the results of the draft riots was increased residential segregation. So up until then, you had blacks living in Lower Manhattan, next to the Lorillards, next to all kinds of people. Then they're in Williamsburg, living among a German population, and so forth. When residential segregation starts to occur in the aftermath of the draft riots and continues, I think that that's where you start getting all those issues of poverty, which has to do with, all the debates. How much money is this school system here going to get? How do you distribute city funds and so forth and so on? Okay. Yes.
I was interested that you said about Sugar Hill was just a little village, a few little houses. It became then, at what point, a very wealthy area.
Right. Okay, so that's Harlem, and my story is Lower Manhattan and Brooklyn, Lower Manhattan. So what I'm talking about is, if you trace the white elite, they started living all the way at the tip of Manhattan, and then they moved up to St. John's Park. So that would be around North Moore Street, around there. And that was like way out for them. And then in the 1850s, when they moved still farther north, and if you were really a white elite somebody, you lived above Bleecker Street. So that's what we're talking about geographically. If you lived above Bleecker Street, Bond Street, that was the really fancy area. So, the rest was just kind of wasteland. And then gradually you get the building up in Fifth Avenue, Park Avenue, so forth and so on. So the story of Harlem, which I do not know a lot about, but you live in Harlem. Okay, so you can speak out. It's in 1910 and around then when there's a determined effort on the part of black leadership and black real estate people to build up Harlem, housing for blacks in Harlem. So that's at the beginning of the 20th century. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Yes. Yes, okay. So the schooling for African Americans, what were called the African Free Schools, were initially formed by the New York Manumission Society. And they were considered charity schools, so they were not public schools. And they were founded in the 1790s and maintained by the New York Manumission Society until 1833. So at the time when Peter Guignon and his friends go to the Mulberry Street School, it is a charity school run by the Manumission Society. By the time that Philip White goes to the Lawrence Street School, it's now being run by the Public School Society, which then I think in 1853 becomes the New York Board of Education. And there was a very strong feeling on the part of black parents that the Manumission Society did much better for black students than the Public School Society, and that there was a real deterioration. And so basically there was some closing of what they called the public schools, so I guess they were the junior high schools, high schools, and just maintaining primary schools. This is under the Public School Society. Deterioration of the buildings. When we had some of the descriptions of the buildings are just like incredible. And just lousy conditions. And the black community is really upset by that. Okay, all right. So if you go to my archive, under the making of the Black Elite, the school, or whatever. I found in the New York Historical Society, I was looking through the ledgers of the public school society in the New York Historical Society, and thinking, what am I doing? Because it's just like $10 to so-and-so for this and that, and I'm like, this is crazy. And all of a sudden, I came across a note where Philip White, who had been 16 at the time, was being paid $3 to keep the Lawrence Street building, to make fires for the Lawrence Street building to keep it warm in 1840. So it tells you how bad the schools were, right? And that my great-grandfather, I mean, it's so Dickensian, isn't it? Starts out by making fires and getting $3 every 3 months for making the fires. And his mother, Elizabeth, whitewashes the walls. I found that as well. Yes?
I wanted to ask a question about the emancipation. And, you know, we're coming up on the sesquicentennial, the end of next month. What was the reaction in the Black community? Did you find anything about, were there celebrations?
Okay. Are you talking about New York State or national? Oh, okay, because.
What was the reaction of the Black Elite?
They were thrilled. So along, there were two issues. One, they were very leery about Lincoln in the beginning. There was a...
You found documentation.
You go to the newspapers, run your microfilm. So they were very leery of Lincoln. They really wondered what he was up to. And so forth. When the Emancipation Proclamation came out, they were elated. And all the people, Henry Highland Garnett would have been one of the major players there. And he was, I have an image of, well, if we got up, I have an image of him on the archive, But when he and George Downing butted heads. So George Downing was this real integrationist, and Henry Highland Garnett was the kind of a separatist and nationalist and so forth. So he had been very leery of Lincoln. But when Lincoln issued the Emancipation Proclamation, Henry Highland Garnett was just over the top elated. The emancipation was twinned with one other issue, which was the right for Black men to fight in the Union Army. And that was so, so important. So after the Emancipation Proclamation, Henry Highland Garnett went to, you know, was all out. And actually, so the regiments, the Black regiments in New York, it was the 20th, the 26th, and the 31st, I think, colored regiments, were formed in the wake of the draft riots. The Union Lee Club got together and said, what happened in our city, our beloved city of New York, is so shameful, and we have to repair what we've done. And so they initiated the forming of these colored regiments, right? The 20th, the 26th, the 31st. And Henry Highland Garnett was so excited about that. So that would have happened at the end of 1863 and in 64. And then, of course, Lincoln was also in favor of Black regiments. So emancipation and the right of Black men to fight as soldiers in the Union Army were kind of twinned in the minds of the Black leadership. And when that happened, when Lincoln did that, they were so elated. And when Lincoln was assassinated, you can read all the newspapers of the, you know, African-American newspapers and the despair that was felt was very real. Yes?
You mentioned Charity Hicks related to the Black side of the Quaker Hicks family. Did the Quaker Society of Friends come out of your research in any way?
Did what?
The Society of Friends, the Quakers, did you come across in your research any of their influence at this time, because they were quite active early on?
Right. All I know is that they were the backbone of the New York Manumission Society. Yeah. So that's kind of the extent. So members of the Manumission Society were either Quakers or they were members of Trinity Church, some of them as well. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yes.
And then you.
I am a 19th century person. If you say Victorian, I'm like, yes, I get it. If you say modernist, I'm like, I don't know what you're talking about. So my very latest text that I'll deal with, and I'm a literary critic, is 1903, The Souls of Black Folk, which has still got a very 19th century sensibility. I mean, that's Du Bois, he's really a 19th century person. After that, I'm just lost. I just don't get it. And I don't get the Harlem Renaissance. Although, you know, today I'm teaching Their Eyes Were Watching God next week, and so I was rereading Their Eyes Were Watching God and loving it. So I don't know. So what were you thinking that I could, I don't know, did you have any thought about what I could do? I mean, one of the things that's so interesting is that nobody has heard, very few people have heard about, as you said, of this black elite in this earlier period. And so one of the things would be to explore, I don't know exactly what I'm, how the Harlem Renaissance came to be the Harlem Renaissance, right? So, wait, to look at black activism in the 20th century?
Well, black elitism influences what happens in the 20th century, which is, way more complex. Or did it?
Yeah.
I would imagine there's a reaction, though. I would imagine there's a reaction, or a revolution, really, to be exact, because we're talking about now the clash of classes in the 20th century, more so.
Yeah.
In the same way that we're looking at, you know, poor Irish and Jewish immigrants, or
Eastern
European and Italian immigrants, and the culture and class clashes that you see.
Right.
So it would be interesting to find
Yeah. No, I'm a 19th century person, so it's not going to happen. You had a question.
Yes, it's always been confusing to me the terms black, white, color. Is this self-identifying?
Yep, very, very good question. The term African was the first term used by whites, but as well as by blacks. And for blacks, it was a source of pride, our African heritage. And this goes through maybe to the 1820s or so. And then black people themselves, so you have the African free schools. Black people in the 1830s, black New Yorkers, I'm going to call them, in the 1830s petitioned the public school society
to rename the school the Colored Schools. And the newspaper of the period is called The Colored American. So it's a very deliberate attempt to get away from African origins and to posit yourself as a colored American. So American is what you are, and colored is the adjective. And colored is nothing more than skin color. You know, it's like blue eyes or brown hair or blonde hair. I'm a blonde-haired American. I'm a colored American. So that's a real, real shift. So you could argue that that is the beginning of African-American or black nationalism. We are this nation. We came here kidnapped and enslaved as Africans. Now we are here, and we need to figure out what our national identity is. Negro is used ethnologically in opposition to or along with Caucasian, Mongoloid, etc. So you have Frederick Douglass writing an article, I think in the 1850s, what is the Negro ethnologically speaking? The term black is used all the way throughout as, you know, yeah, all the way throughout as black people, whatever. You get to the end of the century, and T. Thomas Fortune, who was the editor of the New York Age, and my grandfather, Jerome Bowers Peterson, was his co-editor. He all of a sudden said, okay, now we're going to call ourselves Afro-American. And I'm not quite sure how he got there. So in the 20th century, when I was a child, and I had all these elderly aunts and uncles around me, they used, especially the ones from Jamaica especially, used the term colored. And as my sisters and I grew up, they're like, what does that mean? Are we purple? Are we blue? Whatever, you know? They also used Negro. And then I'm sure you were around when black became popular. I mean, I was in graduate school at Yale, and I went to bed as a Negro one day, and I woke up the next day as black. Yeah. I mean, it was so stark, the difference, right? And then there was Afro-American, and then African-American, right? The dismissing of Afro to an African. But you're absolutely right that this was all, it wasn't happenstance, it wasn't whimsy. It was all very much